The tape that you are about to hear has been declassified by disability and disadvantage analysts at CFMU Radio. This taped record of conversation had never been heard before being released to you, the CFMU listener. This tape has been condensed and edited from live, personal, or telephone conversation. You will hear privileged discussions, damning indictments, and stark revelations. Once known collectively only to the agents intercepting them, these files have been tagged with the distinct identifier, disrespect. Disrespect brings you a news review for people with disabilities and disadvantages. These are not the newspaper stories that we read to you, but these are adapted versions for the radio, the newspapers, and the reporters are read in the broadcast. Liam deserves the right to sight. After being stonewalled by OHIP, a desperate family hopes private donations will cover the cost of treatment they say is needed to save their young son's vision. Dave and Christina Reed have hit a brick wall, waiting for OHIP to step up and pay for the treatment their son Liam desperately needs to save his sight. Liam, 3, was born with PFVS Norrie's disease, a rare retinal disorder that will cause him to go blind if he doesn't get treatment from a Michigan specialist. They've already paid $45,000 from their own pocket for Liam's treatment with world-renowned specialist Dr. Michael Trees. They had to skip an appointment with him at Detroit's Beaumont Hospital in April because they didn't have $5,000 to pay the bill. With another appointment coming up next week, they're hoping the folk who came forward to offer financial help when the author first wrote about Liam will once again offer support. We have to take this into our own hands. They're devastated their request has been denied. They were promised a meeting with Health Minister Deb Matthews, which still hasn't happened. Although the Health Minister called the family and urged them to return to the Hospital for Sick Children, where doctors performed an unsuccessful surgery on Liam's right eye almost 3 years ago. Liam's treatment can cost as little as $5,000 a year for two evaluations under anesthetic, or as high as $30,000 a year if he needs retinal reattachment or removal of scar tissue. When he turns 7, it's likely the examinations will no longer have to be done under anesthetic and the price will drop to $350 in evaluation. The Reeds are trapped. Liam has already made significant gains with treatment in Michigan. While they're grateful to Sick Kids for repairing his cleft palate, they just don't believe the hospital has the expertise Liam now needs. Why would their own doctor recommend out-of-country care if he could be treated here, they ask. The Reeds MPP, Oshawa Tory, Christine Elliott, is shocked the government has failed Liam. I'm appalled that the Reed family has been forced to appeal to the public to receive the treatment that Liam rightly deserves. The McGuinty government truly has lost its way, she said. If you want to help Liam, go to liamseyes.blogspot.com. That's Liam's Eyes, LIAMSEYES. .blogspot.com and click on donate. That story in the Sunday Sun by Christina Blizzard at Queen's Park. MPs flee after stormy session. MPs headed to the ridings after a tumultuous session where the left versus right divide deepened, ideological differences amplified, and the development of natural resources was both attacked and embraced. The conservative used their majority to ram their economic agenda home, a hammer approach that limited debate and restricted openness of committees. NDP leader Thomas Mulcair said his party stood up to the mean-spiritedness of the Conservatives and fought tirelessly to defend its interests. Harper barked at wealthy nations ringing the Mediterranean whose inaction on a financial crisis is spooking the global economy. What angered opposition benches most were changes to old-age security and employment insurance and speeding up environmental reviews of major projects. Measures the opposition was powerless to stop. And that by Mark Dunn of the QMI agency in the Free Daily 24 Hours. Woman in right to die case, still here for a living. Gloria Taylor watches from the inside as her body deteriorates. Lou Gehrig's disease has robbed her of the ability to walk or drive, leaving her unable to visit most of her friends and family. She uses a feeding tube. She describes her hands as nearly useless. Her voice is beginning to fade. Taylor knows her life is ending, but she says a BC court ruling that struck down Canada's ban on doctor-assisted suicide now gives her control over when and how that will happen. Taylor, 64, who lives in Kelowna, BC, was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease, or ALS, in 2009. Last year, she joined other plaintiffs in a lawsuit challenging Canada's ban on doctor-assisted suicide. A BC Supreme Court judge ruled the law is unconstitutional and gave Parliament a year to rewrite it. Taylor was granted an immediate exemption, though she said she's made no decisions about when or if she will ask a doctor to help her end her life. Judge Lynn Smith issued a complex 395-page ruling that concluded the ban on doctor-assisted suicide violates two sections of the Charter, the right to equality and the right to life, liberty, and security of the person. Smith concluded the law must allow physician-assisted suicide in cases involving patients who are diagnosed with a serious illness or disability and who are experiencing intolerable physical or psychological suffering with no chance of improvement. The patients in such scenarios must personally request physician-assisted death, must be free from coercion, and cannot be clinically depressed, wrote Smith. Taylor said she hopes Ottawa accepts the court's decision. We've emerged from the dark ages to realize that dying is part of living, and it means we no longer have to die a horrible, tormented death, said Taylor. Critics have warned allowing assisted suicide will put the elderly and people with disabilities at risk, and religious groups have decried the idea of the state sanctioning suicide. Archbishop J. Michael Miller of the Catholic Archdiocese of Vancouver said the decision sadly reflects a distorted view of equality rights that emphasizes autonomy over human dignity and the value of life. If the case ends up before the Supreme Court of Canada, it won't be the first time the country's highest court has tackled the issue of assisted suicide. The court heard a case 2 decades ago involving Sue Rodriguez, who also had ALS and wanted help from a doctor to end her life. The court ruled against her in 1993, though she killed herself anyway, with the help of a physician the following year. And that in the Hamilton Spectator by the Canadian Press. No money for forced sterilization victims in the U.S. Between 1929 and 1974, North Carolina forcibly sterilized about 7,600 people whom it deemed feeble-minded or otherwise undesirable. Many were poor black women. Now, the first serious proposal to compensate the victims has failed, with Republican lawmakers saying the budget is too tight to give them any money. At this point, I have lost all hope, one of the measure's biggest supporters, Representative Earlene Parman, said. And that from the Associated Press in the Daily Free Metro News. Also from the U.S., a massive program on the verge of collapse. Chances are you haven't heard any dire warnings about another massive entitlement program that will soon go insolvent if Congress doesn't act. The pot of money the Social Security Administration is using to cover disability insurance is projected to run dry in 2016. That means more than 9 million out-of-work disabled Americans, plus their spouses and children, who also qualify for benefits, would see their checks shrink 21%. Incoming payroll taxes will cover 79% of the benefit. President Obama didn't address the looming shortfall in his 2012 budget, nor did House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan, Republican, Wisconsin. That both parties are ignoring the issue aggravates Republican Senator Tom Coburn, Oklahoma, one of the few lawmakers who wants the program overhauled. Nobody wants to touch things where they can be criticized, he complains. The disability rolls have swollen 23% since 2007, in part because of the bad economy. Many people who can't find work exhaust their unemployment benefits and then turn to disability for assistance. The benefit pays an average $1,111 a month per worker, says Ken Nibali, a retired associate commissioner of the program. They figure, I do have trouble working and I'm going to apply and see if I'm eligible. In West Virginia, 9% of residents from the ages of 18 to 64 received the aid in 2010, the most of any state. Utah and Alaska had the lowest rate, 2.8%. Disabled workers, regardless of their age, can go on Medicare after a two-year waiting period. That's another incentive for Americans working low-income jobs without health insurance to try to qualify for disability, says Nibali. Fewer than 1% of those who begin collecting disability go back to work, government statistics show. Meanwhile, periodic reviews meant to ensure that people drawing government checks actually are entitled to them aren't getting done. The Social Security Administration says it doesn't have the funds to clear a backlog of 1.4 million reviews. Critics, including Coburn, say it wouldn't be hard to find savings by demanding more screening of applicants and more incentives for them to rejoin the workforce if Congress only tried. Democratic Senator Max Baucus, Montana, who chairs the committee that sets Social Security policy, says lawmakers are too busy with the expiration of the Bush tax cuts, the automatic reductions in defense spending, and overhauling the tax code to take up broad changes to disability insurance. That by Brian Fehler in Bloomberg Businessweek. How to serve the ill and addicted. I am a lawyer whose clients live with severe mental health disabilities, often complicated by addictions. In his report on provincial spending, Don Drummond pointed out that my clients and others like them cost the healthcare system billions as they use emergency wards for primary health care and emergency psychiatric support. In addition, they cycle through the shelters, police departments, courts, and jails. As a result of their cognitive and perceptual impairments, my clients often have difficulty remembering date, time, and place. This leads to additional criminal charges when they fail to attend court or probation hearings. It also means they have difficulty attending scheduled medical appointments or returning administrative paperwork to housing providers. This leads to evictions, and then the whole cycle starts all over again. The Drummond Report identifies mental health and addictions as one of the most serious problems increasing Ontario's health care costs. Ontario spends between $10 billion and $20 billion badly on people with severe mental health problems and addictions. It is absurd to spend $10 to $20 billion on 30,000 people or to spend $100 million warehousing 5,000 people. There are an estimated 5,000 homeless people in Toronto on any given night. Ontario and Toronto need to reorganize how services are provided to make them more easily accessible to people with mental health and addiction issues. The problem is that services are delivered through institutions our clients have difficulty accessing and that the provision of services is fragmented through different institutions and silos. An effective way to deal with my clients would be, in the words of a really sensible community social worker, to offer services where they eat or where they sleep. Most of my clients go to drop-in centers during the day. The drop-in centers offer food and someone to talk to in a comfortable environment. Many drop-ins also have showers and laundry services. In a drop-in, my clients have names and are individuals. A principle of Canadian democracy and human rights is that everyone should be able to access public services. All levels of government have a duty to accommodate applicants' disabilities to facilitate access to public services. If we acknowledge my client's disabilities, we should not ask them to negotiate voicemail or come to appointments. If services are accessible in the same place they eat or take a shower, my clients will be more likely to be able to maintain medical and legal relationships. If Ontario and Toronto acknowledge my client's basic human rights, then the Ministries of Health and Justice should fund the drop-in centers as hubs for service delivery, pay for the food, and get doctors, social workers, nurses, lawyers, housing workers, and peer support workers to cooperate to help our clients negotiate the bureaucracies of health and justice. This would improve my clients' lives and their health, and it would save taxpayers a fortune. And that by Sarah Chartall, a lawyer with Roach Schwartz & Associates in Toronto, in the Toronto Star. A tribute to where it all started, 2120 South Michigan, Chess Records. George Thorogood, from the man who started it all, Chuck Berry, who wrote this tune. Let It Rock. In the heat of the day, got a movie around a little, working on a rail with a steel dollar hill. I gotta find some money, buy some brand new shoes. Gotta find a woman, chase away my blues. She don't love me when I'm singing in the sun. Payday coming and my work is all done, yeah. Healthcare cuts spark fury. Mohammed Asif will have to choose between food for his three young children and medication for his ill wife when Ottawa's planned cuts to refugee healthcare kick in. I need to decide if my kids should suffer hunger or let my wife go without her medicines, said the 35-year-old Afghan man, who worked for the Canadian military in Kandahar for 3 years before his family resettled here as government-sponsored refugees last year. Demonstrations were planned to demand the federal government reverse the cuts, which took effect June 30th. Immigration Minister Jason Kenney has said the changes will save Ottawa $100 million over 5 years and discourage unfounded refugees from taking advantage of Canada's generosity. His proposed cuts, however, have been met with growing opposition from the healthcare sector concerned about the potential impact on the health of refugees and Canadians. said Dr. Meb Rashid of the Crossroads Clinic at Women's College Hospital. We believe it is inhumane to deny them access to the health care they need to begin their new lives in Canada. Dr. Michael Stephenson of the Access Alliance Multicultural Health and Community Services said the economics of the health cuts just won't work. It will make it much harder for us to do our job by removing the patient's preventive and life-saving medicines. Hamidullah Amiri, who arrived in Canada with his wife and daughter in May from Afghanistan, is grateful his family does not have any health problems, but he too is worried. "We're grateful that Canada opened its door for us," said Amiri, 26, who worked for the Canadian Forces in Kabul and came as a government-sponsored refugee. "But you just don't know when you are going to get sick." Days of Action were endorsed by 15 health-related professional bodies from the Royal College of Physicians and Surgeons of Canada to the Canadian Pediatric Society, Canadian Nurses Association, and Canadian Association of Social Workers. And that in the Toronto Star by Nicholas Kung, immigration reporter. "Don't reduce health care for refugees," Ontario urges. Planned cuts will hurt everyone in province, Health Minister warns. In a letter to Federal Health Minister Leona Aglukkaq and Immigration Minister Jason Kenney, Ontario Health Minister Deb Matthews urged Ottawa to reverse its decision to significantly reduce health coverage for refugee claimants. Quote, "By abdicating your responsibility towards some of the most vulnerable in our society, you've effectively downloaded federal costs onto the provincial health care system," Matthews wrote in a letter. As of Saturday, all refugee claimants lost their supplemental benefits. Those who are rejected after exhausting all appeals will not be eligible for free health care of any kind unless their conditions pose a risk to public health or safety. The changes are expected to save the federal government $100 million over 5 years. The funding cuts for medications and other early health care interventions for refugees will deny the care for many people in the province, Matthews warned. Ontario is home to almost half of Canada's refugees. One downtown hospital estimates $1.3 million in annual costs to care for refugees, much of which they will no longer be able to claim, Matthews' letter said. This cost could rise if they have to contend with unchecked medical conditions. The result will be greater pressure on our health care system for all Ontarians. And again, that by Nicholas Kung, immigration reporter. Funny they didn't raise that when the social service costs were cut. MDs rally against upcoming cuts. Refugee claimants lose supplemental benefits as of Saturday. Ottawa Canadian doctors are ready to make noise about the consequences of cuts to a federal program that will restrict health coverage for refugee claimants. "We are stubborn, we are upset, and we are professionals. The government is hurting our patients. We will not stop, ever, and we will not forget," Dr. Philip Berger, Chief of Family and Community Medicine at St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto, told a news conference in Ottawa on Wednesday. A group of grassroots physicians calling itself Canadian Doctors for Refugee Care is looking to study and publicize any negative impacts of upcoming changes to the Interim Health Program, which provides temporary costs of medical coverage to refugee claimants. The group has begun to distribute a detailed case reporting survey, which they call the Refugee Health Outcome Monitoring Evaluation System, or Refugee HOMES, to physicians and healthcare workers nationwide. "Our network of doctors across Canada will be reporting to us the details of any harm or death resulting from the changes," said Berger. "The doctors plan to share these stories with the public, the media, and with Conservative MPs and cabinet ministers, both at their offices and when they make any health-related announcements," said Federal Health Minister Jason Kenney. "Canadians are a very generous people, and Canada has a generous immigration system. However, we do not want to ask Canadians to pay for benefits for protected persons and refugee claimants that are more generous than what they are entitled to themselves." Kenney also suggested generous health care attracts bogus claims. "With this reform, we are also taking away an incentive from people who may be considering filing an unfounded refugee claim in Canada," he said. That story by Joanna Smith at the Ottawa Bureau of the Toronto Star. Compromise puts fee cuts for Ontario doctors on hold. The Ontario government is halting plans to have fees paid to doctors for certain diagnostic testing after heart specialists and others warned the cut could hurt patient care and drive some physicians out of the province. The 50% reduction to payments for self-referral testing, which applies to doctors who use their own equipment to perform exams such as ultrasounds and x-rays, was set to take effect on July the 1st. But after an outcry from many physicians and patients, the province has suspended the fee cut while a government-appointed panel reviews the issue of diagnostic testing. The Ontario Association of Cardiologists welcomed the reprieve and is cautiously optimistic a resolution can be worked out. But the Ontario Medical Association, the OMA, has declined to participate in the panel, contending the matter should be part of its negotiations with the government. The province announced the diagnostic testing payment cut in May, along with 36 other changes to OHIP's fee schedule, after talks with the OMA broke down. The 50% reduction to fees for self-referral diagnostic testing was projected to save the government $44 million in 2012-13. Health Minister Deb Matthews warned those savings must still be achieved, even if the government's advisory panel recommends scrapping the self-referral cut. Ms. Matthews has repeatedly maintained that doctors who use their own equipment for testing are more likely to order exams. If there's a better way to achieve the goal of appropriate use of diagnostics, then we want to work with doctors to get it, Mrs. Matthews said. The advisory panel, whose membership is still being finalized, is expected to present recommendations to the minister later this summer. Cardiologists say a 50% cut would mean they would lose money on nearly every diagnostic test performed in their clinics. However, if they refer patients back to their family doctors with a recommendation for testing, they'd get full payment if the exam is ordered and done at their clinics. Ontario Association of Cardiologists President Bill Hughes said, "Our commitment is to ensure that every test is done on the right patient at the right time for the right reasons. Modifying payment based on self-referral alone is not appropriate." And that by Renata D'Alessio at the Globe and Mail. Doctors wage by-election battle. Ontario's doctors are taking their war against the Liberal government to the battleground of the forthcoming Kitchener-Waterloo by-election. The Ontario Medical Association has unleashed a $1 million round of attack ads aimed directly at Premier Dalton McGuinty for imposing $338 million worth of fee cuts on physicians and for what they call unfair contract negotiations. The Kitchener-Waterloo seat was vacated after longtime Progressive Conservative MPP Elizabeth Whitmer resigned last month to become chair of the Workplace Safety Insurance Board. The by-election gives the Liberals a shot at majority government. The Grits hold 52 seats, excluding Speaker Dave Levac, a Liberal MPP, versus a combined 53 for the Progressive Conservatives and New Democrats. No date has been set for the by-election. The OMA plans to saturate the local market with newspaper and TV ads warning of what they call a looming provincial $1 billion cut to health care and longer wait times for services. They argue that imposing fee cuts on doctors is a heavy-handed approach that violates the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and the right of doctors to bargain collectively. The doctors are expected to file a court challenge against the province soon. The province is deferring some OHIP fee cuts and plans to set up an expert panel to study physician concerns, but the OMA is not participating. It's not the OMA's job to tell people how to vote, but we certainly won't shy away from informing voters about the current status of health care in the community and what lies ahead, said OMA President Dr. Douglas Weir. A recent poll of Ontario's doctors conducted by Nanos Research showed 41% are considering moving out of the province and 33% would retire early if the cuts occur. In Kitchener-Waterloo, the doctors argue the fee changes will mean the 20,000 patients in the area who still don't have a family doctor will either wait longer to find one or won't be able to do so. The new television ads, which will air until the end of July, are the first to attack the Premier outright. The ad features a dripping IV and an unflattering clip of the Premier waving his hands. Dalton McGuinty is cutting OHIP by nearly $1 billion. It'll make it harder for me to find a doctor for my kids. It'll mean fewer tests and procedures for my parents, says a female voice in the ad. Some cuts are just irresponsible. It's time for Dalton McGuinty to work with doctors and put patients first. That by Tanya Talaga in the Queen's Park Bureau of the Toronto Star. Police trial sent strong message, experts say. Some consider officers' convictions a watershed. The former Mountie who headed the police corruption investigation that led to 8 convictions says the jury verdict sends a strong signal that the public expects officers to act with integrity. It's not negotiable, former RCMP Assistant Commissioner John Neely, now an Ottawa consultant, said in a phone interview. After a 5-month trial, a jury found 5 former Toronto Drug Squad officers, John Scherzer, Joseph Miched, Stephen Correa, Ned Mayotis, and Raymond Pillard, guilty of attempting to obstruct justice. The last 3 were also convicted of perjury. The officers were acquitted of 13 other charges. For a police officer to be convicted of lying is extremely serious, former RCMP Assistant Commissioner John Neely said. It doesn't get more serious than that. It's also rare, despite persistent judicial findings of officers lying on the stand, a Star investigation has found. It is also the first, said Heather Pringle, Secretary of the Criminal Lawyers Association, that she was aware of in which a group of officers has been convicted of an offense that strikes at the heart of the administration of justice. Former task force member Jim Cassells, who has previously spoken out, said he's concerned the verdict does nothing to solve the real problems unearthed by the investigation. One only needs to look to the recent revelations of the G20 to see the common threads that weave the fabric of police management in Toronto, he said in an email. Also in an email, former Toronto Police Chief Julian Fantino said, "I did my job, as has the system, and I respect the outcome." Toronto Police Chief Bill Blair refused an interview request. University of Toronto Law Professor Kent Roach said the process may not have seemed efficient, typical of mega trials with multiple accused, but it's important such cases be prosecuted despite the cost and time involved. If the system had just thrown up its hands and said these cases are too hard, too expensive, and too long, I think society would not benefit because there is a social interest in a ruling on the merits, he said. I guess the message is that the rule of law applies to everyone, including police officers. And that by Peter Small of the Courts Bureau at the Toronto Star. Funds cut for young offenders. Provinces outraged by Tory's surprise 20% reduction to youth justice programs. The Conservative government has slashed 20% of federal funding for youth justice programs in Canada, cutting $35.6 million used to supervise and rehabilitate young offenders, the Star has learned. Justice Minister Rob Nicholson made no mention of the drastic cut in a news release that trumpeted continued support for the Youth Justice Services funding program. It's a key federal initiative that has directly transferred money to provinces and territories to deliver services to troubled youth ever since the original Young Offenders Act was passed in 1985. Instead, Nicholson said only that starting next spring, the Conservative government will, quote, continue, unquote, to fund the program at $141.7 million annually. However, federal justice officials confirm that's down from $177.3 million now spent on the program, a level that's been stable for the past several years. It's a significant programming cut. One that was not detailed in the federal budget document directly hits the provinces and represents more than half the $60 million in savings that the federal budget indicated the Justice Department must find next year. Nicholson's press secretary, Julie DeMambro, declined to discuss the impact on programs, saying in an email it's up to the provinces to determine how best to allocate their resources. She referred to unrelated program spending that will continue and said the Federal Justice Department would achieve further savings by focusing on its youth justice priorities, like guns, gangs, and drugs, crime prevention, and youth rehabilitation. She did not respond to a request to interview the minister. That's quite a longer article in the Toronto Star, Sunday, July the 1st, by Tonda McCharles in the Ottawa Bureau. Marin urges more powers for Ombudsman. Watchdog says his reach is too limited. Ombudsman Andre Marin used the release of his annual report to urge the government to give his office oversight powers in municipalities, universities, school boards, and hospitals, or MUSH. In the last calendar year, Marin received 18,541 complaints, up 27% from 2010-11, but was not able to investigate a record 2,539 related to the so-called MUSH sector, because such institutions fall beyond his jurisdiction. But Marin is optimistic Premier Dalton McGuinty is finally listening after the Orange scandal, which was sparked by a Star investigation. The Star discovered a confusing web of Orange for-profit entities, high salaries, and a questionable $6.7 million marketing agreement now being investigated by the Ontario Provincial Police. I had a couple conversations with the Premier, who certainly appeared to have an open mind and was asking me many questions and wanted to know what my concerns were. Ontarians deserve stronger oversight and greater transparency. There is no independent, impartial complaint mechanism for either hospitals or children's aid societies. No one who has the investigative powers and independence of an ombudsman or who can resolve the kind of issues that we can. NDP MPP Franz Gelinas Nickelbelt warned there could be other oranges lurking out there. Green Party leader Mike Schreiner, who attended Marin's news conference, said the ombudsman deserves more authority. The orange scandal is a stark reminder of how important oversight and accountability is, especially when the government delegates public service delivery to private players, said Schreiner. The Liberals' privatization agenda will further erode transparency and accountability without oversight. Look no further than Orange for the possible results. However, Progressive Conservative MPP Steve Clark from Leeds Grenville isn't sold on the idea of giving the Ombudsman's Office greater powers. Contrary to what Marin said, the government had all the tools it needed to provide oversight over Orange. They just didn't use them, said Clark. And that story by Tanya Talaga and Robert Benzie at the Queen's Park Bureau of the Toronto Star. Joey Louie Walker has some advice. What you need is black girls.
Sounds like rock and roll. cleaner. Her name's Aretha. Have you heard her? Her name is Bertha. Have you seen her? Her name's Shamika. I need a woman to get down.
This item from Tuesday, June the 12th, Hamilton Spectator. We've been holding it back because we are still working on trying to get an interview about it. Activist lobby for the disabled and unemployed. A group of activists at the Center for Equality, Rights, and Accommodation is calling on government to shift the way they address homelessness, social assistance rates, and food insecurity for people living in poverty. And it's taken its complaint to an Ontario Superior Court using the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms to bolster its arguments. It's a real concern, Bruce Porter, co-director of the Social Rights Advocacy Center, said at a Spectator editorial board meeting. We have to recognize that it's a real crisis, inadequate standards of living. The group is using Section 7 of the Charter, the legal rights for the security of a person, and Section 15, which states that every individual is equal before and under the law and has the right to equal protection and equal benefit of the law without discrimination. The group argues that the provincial and federal governments have violated those rights by not implementing effective national and provincial strategies to reduce and eliminate homelessness. Hamilton has roughly 59,000 people, or 12% of its population, depending on social assistance through Ontario Works or Ontario Disability Support. For many, it's not enough to live above the poverty line. It's shocking to see so much hunger and homelessness in such an affluent country, said Porter. The situation is frustrating to Hamilton Roundtable on Poverty member Laura Katari, who says the government is spending more money to maintain poverty than to eliminate poverty as it continues to neglect the growing issue in Canada. Craig Foy of the Hamilton Community Legal Clinic has a suggestion. Have the government provide Canadians with adequate levels of social assistance income support. I guarantee it will make a difference across Ontario. And that by Hilary Caton at the Hamilton Spectator. Teams are formed of five blind or visually impaired blindfolded players, a sighted player, and a sighted defensive assistant. The two sighted members serve as base coaches. There are no pitchers or catchers. Instead, a batter throws and hits the ball, a regular-sized baseball with five holes and two sleigh bells inside. Fielders must hear where it lands, which must be within the diamond. The sighted players clap paddles at second and third base to orient runners. First base is a beeping mat. The twists for blind players were honed through two decades of trials, spearheaded above all by Alfredo Meli, a former Italian baseball champion as player and coach, who died in 2010. Enthusiasts are trying to spread the game. Contacts have been made with blind players in Cuba, Hungary, France, and Germany. Matteo Briglia, a software developer who is blind, ran for the first time after he started playing for the Lampi Milano team 3 years ago. He's driving through the United States where he hopes to promote this brand of blind baseball. I think people think of blind baseball as a boring sport with a lot of fumbling around, he said. But the Italian version of the game is faster and fun with more runs and more plays. And that from the Bologna Journal by Elisabetta Povoledo in the New York Times. Teams are formed of five blind or visually impaired blindfolded players, a sighted player and a sighted defensive assistant. The two sighted members serve as base coaches. There are no pitchers or catchers. Instead, a batter throws and hits the ball, a regular-sized baseball with five holes and two sleigh bells inside. Fielders must hear where it lands, which must be within the diamond. The sighted players clap paddles at second and third base to orient runners. First base is a beeping mat. The twists for blind players were honed through two decades of trials, spearheaded above all by Alfredo Meli, a former Italian baseball champion as player and coach, who died in 2010. Enthusiasts are trying to spread the game. Contacts have been made with blind players in Cuba, Hungary, France, and Germany. Matteo Briglia, a software developer who is blind, ran for the first time after he started playing for the Lampi Milano team 3 years ago. He's driving through the United States where he hopes to promote this brand of blind baseball. I think people think of blind baseball as a boring sport with a lot of fumbling around, he said. But the Italian version of the game is faster and fun with more runs and more plays. And that from the Bologna Journal by Elisabetta Povoledo in the New York Times. Teams are formed of five blind or visually impaired blindfolded players, a sighted player and a sighted defensive assistant. The two sighted members serve as base coaches. There are no pitchers or catchers. Instead, a batter throws and hits the ball, a regular-sized baseball with five holes and two sleigh bells inside. Fielders must hear where it lands, which must be within the diamond. The sighted players clap paddles at second and third base to orient runners. First base is a beeping mat. The twists for blind players were honed through two decades of trials, spearheaded above all by Alfredo Meli, a former Italian baseball champion as player and coach, who died in 2010. Enthusiasts are trying to spread the game. Contacts have been made with blind players in Cuba, Hungary, France, and Germany. Matteo Briglia, a software developer who is blind, ran for the first time after he started playing for the Lampi Milano team 3 years ago. He's driving through the United States where he hopes to promote this brand of blind baseball. I think people think of blind baseball as a boring sport with a lot of fumbling around, he said. But the Italian version of the game is faster and fun with more runs and more plays. And that from the Bologna Journal by Elisabetta Povoledo in the New York Times. Network boosts effort to treat depression. They are an unlikely sales team. Phil Upshall is a former lawyer who was active in the Conservative Party until his life spiraled out of control because of mental illness. Zul Murali is a neuroscientist at the University of Ottawa and the Royal Ottawa Mental Health Centre. Together, the two friends made a pitch to the Conservative government for a new research network with 80 scientists working together on more effective approaches to help hundreds of thousands of Canadians suffering from depression. Their success, the federal budget included $5 million to establish the Canadian Depression Research and Intervention Network, is the result of their hard work, but it's also a reflection of the Conservative government's research priorities at a time when money is tight and mental health has emerged as an important issue. Ottawa is still considering how it will proceed with the groundbreaking National Strategy for Mental Health released last month, but may favor collaborations like this one. The researchers involved in the network hope to do long-term epidemiological studies to identify different types of depression based not only on symptoms but also on what is happening in a patient's brain. What particular circuits in the brain are responsible for what particular symptoms? Then you could refine your treatment based on what you are seeing in the brain, says Dr. Murali. The network will also focus on two issues that the two men say came up repeatedly in conversations with cabinet ministers: youth suicide and post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Phil always brings us back to the patient. We want to make sure we always have that voice in whatever we do, Dr. Morali said. This is not research that is going to sit on a shelf, Mr. Upshaw said. It's going to change the way we treat and deal with people, not just in hospitals, but in communities. The key word is intervention, to translate research into primary and secondary care for patients. That story by Anne McElroy in Ottawa in the Globe and Mail. And also from Ottawa, Presto Card rollout hit snag in Ottawa. A pre-launch trial of Presto Cards went so poorly it's still unclear when OC Transpo, the city's bus agency, can expect to have the system running. Although Metrolinx CEO Bruce McQuaig said he'll be in Ottawa today to discuss a revised timetable with officials there. The delay has some Ottawa Transit users questioning the province's decision to invent its own fare card system rather than going with an external provider. This isn't rocket science. You go to Tim Hortons and use your Tim card, and it's fine, said Paul Norris, who registered 5 Presto cards for his Ottawa's family as part of the trial. He says only 3 of 55 taps successfully deducted bus fare from their cards. The bigger problem, he said, is that delaying the Presto launch has put the bus fare system in chaos. OC Transpo had overhauled its fares to coincide with the Presto launch to encourage its 200,000 riders to convert. The delay is going to cost $100,000 a month, according to the Ottawa Citizen. Of two issues, the first is a confusing signal when the customer taps the card. The reader should emit a sound and a green light. In Ottawa, the readers were showing a combination of green, red, green signals. The red means the transaction didn't occur, and if it becomes green again, it creates confusion for the customer and the operator. We've had to implement a solution, and that's being deployed in the testing phase right now, said McQuaig. Metrolinx officials are referring to the second problem as a white screen, a glitch in the software that means the system doesn't shut down properly and therefore doesn't reboot properly. Although the field tests are designed to isolate these kinds of issues, McQuaig admitted he would have liked the problems to have been solved by now. TTC chair Karen Stintz said she's watching the Ottawa experience closely. If there are issues with Presto, the TTC needs to know before it rolls out the card to its 1.5 million riders. It's not known yet what kind of card readers would be installed on TTC streetcars and buses. The other Toronto area transit systems use readers from Thales. But Scheit Bachmann won the Ottawa contract in a competitive bidding process. The TTC could have a different supplier, said McQuaig. That by Tess Kalinowski, transportation reporter for the Toronto Star. Hey, sound familiar, Hamiltonians? No-cost banking, the end of an age. Boomers beware, Toronto Dominion Bank could be setting a trend by discontinuing its no-fee account for new customers age 60 and older. With our aging population, it's easy to see Toronto Dominion Bank's decision to stop opening no-cost bank accounts for clients aged 60 and older as a trend-setting move. As of March, TD Canada Trust branches have been offering 3 different account packages to older clients with a 25% discount off regular account fees. Other banks and credit unions still offer no-cost banking to seniors, but you can bet they'll be studying TD's move. There's another trend at work here. Bluntly put, many baby boomers don't need banking discounts. The seniors of today are quite different from what they were back when the seniors plan was invented decades ago, said David McVeigh of McVeigh and Associates, a financial services consulting firm. Many are still working and many are better off than seniors were back then. Bank of Nova Scotia's Scotia Plus program for seniors offers cost-free banking for seniors with a refreshing lack of fine print or hidden fees. It also kicks in when customers turn 59, not the usual 60. Bank of Montreal and Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce also offer no-fee accounts to seniors. Credit unions are also an option for seniors seeking no-hassle, no-fee bank accounts. TD's updating of its seniors' accounts represents a modernization in more ways than one. With 2 of the 3 accounts, customers must pay $2 for a monthly paper statement and $2.25 for a passbook. Otherwise, they can use paperless recording where you monitor your account online or download online statements. But both paper statements and passbooks are free to existing Plan C clients. And that story by Rob Carrick, the column Personal Finance in the Globe and Mail. And what's really been our top story this week? Refugee care. Students send 59 cents to Harper. Ask others to do same. A group of university students in Winnipeg is sending 59 cents to Prime Minister Stephen Harper and wants other Canadians to do likewise. The students at the Canadian School of Peacebuilding at the Canadian Mennonite University say that's all it would cost every Canadian a year to restore healthcare benefits to refugees. Starting Saturday, Citizenship and Immigration Canada stopped paying for supplemental health benefits for refugees during their first year here. The cuts prompted healthcare professionals to rally across Canada, including in Winnipeg at the Forks on June 18th, and it inspired the students to take action. They created a video, now posted on YouTube, in which they ask all Canadians to send 59 cents to the Prime Minister's office to let him know that we will not stand for these cuts. It shows people finding loose change in couch cushions and sock drawers, then mailing it to the Prime Minister. We believe that if Canadians stop to consider the effect which these changes will have on the most vulnerable portion of our global society, that our country's annual savings of 59 cents per person to keep the federal interim health program open for refugees will be seen as insignificant, the video says. And that story by the Canadian Press in the weekly Free Metro News. I've got my 59 cents on the way. Hey, and it doesn't even cost a stamp. How about you? That's all the news for Disrespect this week. Come back next week. There may be more. And going out, George Thorogood's tribute to Chicago. Hey, could be a tribute to your town. Chicago Bound.
The woman I love and said, please don't go. But I left that town. You know I left that town. When I left out of Georgia, you know it was Memphis bound. So I stayed in Memphis back in 69. The woman I was loving didn't baby no mind. I left that town. You know I left that town. When I left out of Memphis, you know I was St. Louis bound. Good time. I'm gonna stay in this town. I'm gonna live in this town. I'm gonna stay in Chicago